It's great to be back with all of you again. It is always fun to be back at New Life and to see faces that are familiar, to receive the encouragement of this church. As Ted said, that we have been ministering in Cairo, Egypt for the past 7 years. And in the life that we have, of course, we are very much in daily contact with Muslims. And that is what I would like to speak about today and take this opportunity to share some of the things that we have learned over the years, some of the things that God has been teaching us recently. And one confession before we get too far into it is simply just in the subtitle of what the sermon will be today. If these three remain, and what these three are is, you know, a little clue or a hint, and perhaps you can kind of catch on and see where this is going to go if you'd like to study to search what the inference might be. But more important right now is the three dots that follow. And in the three dots that follow, I confess that this sermon today may perhaps be a bit incomplete. And that's because I'm not sure exactly how to close. I will close. There is a point at the end. I won't just stop down off the stage and leave the mess to Ted. But I'm very comfortable in walking you through a whole lot of this sermon today and some of the things that I've learned and shared. But I'm not necessarily so comfortable in where it's going to end. And so when we get there, please evaluate and see. And when the sermon is finished, after church is done, if there is any thoughts that you have, please come and let me know what you think. Because this is something that's in process for me. And to kind of fill in this picture a little bit too, just to move to the next slide and give you a little bit of background on our life and why this might be important. Over in Egypt, for the past 7 years, I have been working as a journalist. And so the question of Muslims and how we relate to them, most of the time my job is just to report the news on what's going on over there, but there's also the opportunity in which I have the opportunity to write and hopefully help Americans and American Christians understand the Middle East and Muslims and Islam and what is happening. And so at this point, I feel that I do have a bit of a burden to share, and I want to share it correctly in a point that honors God but also resonates with you here in America who are struggling through these issues. I and my family, we live over there. Muslims are normal to us. They're not necessarily in America. Maybe in New Jersey they're a bit more than other parts of the country, but not so much all the time. But there's maybe a little bit of introduction, too, that is worthy to walk through the history with you guys. I say we work as a journalist. That might put me in a mental category, but we're also kind of here as missionaries, and this church has supported us since 2005. It's a long time that we've been able to be here and come back and share and receive the encouragement and prayers of this church. What is the relation between this? So even before we get into the topic of Muslims, just to share a little of where we're coming from, I first went over to the Muslim world in 1998 to a country called Mauritania. It's on the western edge of the Sahara Desert. There's not a lot of people over there. It was a very unique experience, but one that God used in my life to draw me to a long-term service in that part of the world. Fortunately, in 2002, he gave me a wife who was very willing to follow along. He blessed us with children along the way as we spent 2 years in Jordan learning the Arabic language, 2 years in Tunisia, where we tried to figure out where we would be for that long term. And then since 2009, God has enabled us to stay these past 7 years in Egypt. Now, back in 1998, there was a sense in which Christians who had a heart to preach the gospel to Muslims or to the Chinese or to other parts of the world, they ran into a bit of a problem because the missionary model was always to kind of go to a government, say, hi, I'm here as a missionary, I want to preach the gospel. And just because the United States is really the most powerful nation in the world, most countries said, sure, yeah, no problem, here's your visa, you can go do that. Just work with a church, work with a ministry, and everything was okay. But the Muslim nations, the Chinese nations, some others around the world, this never worked. They said, no, we don't want that. We're very happy with our religions. And so back in that early period of time, there was a sense in which, in order to think creatively and to strategically plan how we could be in these nations, there was a sense in which we kind of had to disguise ourselves. And so lots of people were trying to figure out, how can we do this? How can we go and not tell the governments we're missionaries, but do something that lets us in, and then through that we can serve the gospel? Now, over the past 20, 15, 10 years that we've been walking this path, things have shifted and changed and evolved, and of course there's a spectrum on this, but what we do now, and coming back to the point of describing myself as a journalist, well, is that a disguise? Is it a deception? I hope not. And the sense in which where a lot of people have landed, and certainly we have ourselves, is that God has equipped his church to serve everywhere. And maybe you can't go knock on the door and say you're a missionary, but there are certainly people here in these pews who have skills that work in this marketplace. They would work just fine in the marketplace of Cairo, Egypt as well, or any other place in the world. So why not? Now, we have walked this journey. Other people can just step into it. And I've been doing journalism for the past 7 years. There are people who are studying it right and center in college these days who are far more equipped than I am. Why cannot God use people like that, or engineers, or bankers, or whatever, to serve his kingdom throughout the world? And so this is a little bit, and as the sermon goes on, I will try to share a few more examples of how, in particular, this sense of missions can also serve the sense of journalism can also serve in a missions capacity. But hopefully our lives are integrated wholes, that we serve God with all of who we are. And so a little bit of that, and like I said, we've been coming back here to this church basically every 2 years since 2005. I want to take an opportunity to act like a journalist in some sense with you right now. And that's because this time home has been very different in our hearts than it has been in many of the other previous times home. And I think that's because our country is in such a unique spot. Now, maybe 4 years ago, for example, when we came back, the Arab Spring was raging, and that was an exciting time to come back and share what was going on with Christians around the country. But this time home, it seems like our nation is changing. And that is even before the events of the last month that have even changed things in stranger ways than we anticipated when we were living over there, and then thinking we would be back with you. So a lot of these changes that are happening in America seem to have Muslims as their center point. Now, Muslims are only 1% of the American population. We shouldn't let ourselves get carried away with this, but they're on the news all the time. And they're not just over there, they're here too. And their presence here seems to be disturbing to very many of us. Now, is that the right way to think about things? As I'm over there listening to the news of what's happening in the United States and the debates that are going on, I'm getting the sense from Muslims in Egypt that, wow, Americans are thinking like this? Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not so good, but it's different than it often has been. And so, as a journalist, it's my job to ask questions more than give answers. And so I want to ask you a few questions based on current events, things that I'd heard over there in the past several months. Please don't raise your hand to answer any of this stuff. We don't want any rumblings in the pews if you happen to disagree with your neighbor. But if you would be willing to kind of nod your head or give some quiet way to show me if you're thinking on these issues, how you are responding to things that our country are going through right now. And even just now, as I'm coming back to discover where our nation is, this will help give me a sense on how American Christians are responding. So the next slide, if we just start with some of the current events, for example. Are you okay with the Muslim president? Now, let's say that you agreed with him politically, of course. We don't know what party that is, but if he aligned with what you think, and he was a Muslim by birth, by belief, however that works, would you vote for him? You know, rather than the other guy with whom you disagree politically? Or would you not? Is that just too much of a stretch to imagine that you might vote for someone who is a Muslim? Let's take another issue. There are many refugees who are imagined to be coming to America. There are certainly political currents that want Muslims from Syria, from Iraq, for example, to come here. Now, let's imagine that our country does it well and vets them as best they can. Or let's think about refugees or immigrants in general. Are you comfortable inviting these people to our nation to live with us? To find asylum here? Do you want these refugees, in the middle of all of that conflict, to be your neighbor? Is that something you want our nation to embrace? Or maybe you think, like, that's just too much. Some of those people, they might be terrorists infiltrating. Even if they're not, they come with such a different mindset. They're going to change the fabric of our nation. Perhaps you would want to say instead, no, we should keep our doors closed. Is that how you think that we should be behaving as a nation? Caution, perhaps, more than welcome? There's a third issue that I'll just put before you. Now, of course, a lot of these things have to do with the question of security. How do we balance our rights as citizens and the protection of our country when there are certainly people in this world who are out to get us? How do we know who they are? How do we figure that out? Can we know ahead of time? Well, one way to know is simply surveillance. Do you think that our country is in a spot right now that the Muslims who are here, our law enforcement should be surveilling them? We don't know if they're the good guys or the bad guys, but they're Muslims. And we know that certainly Muslims are being radicalized around the world and in our country. Should our good law enforcement people be checking that out? Examining their social media sites, trying to figure out ahead of time who's showing signs of maybe becoming a problem? Is that okay? Now, throughout these three questions, there haven't been a whole lot of heads nodding either way. And whether that's you're too fearful to show or we just don't know, that's really part of the issue. Is there a Christian answer to these things? These questions kind of tear at our conscience in many different ways. As Christians, as Americans, we have a bit of a struggle. We know as Christians we should be loving, whatever that means, of course. As Americans, we want to have rights for all people. But we also have the sense that this is our country. It's, in some sense, historically, culturally, some kind of a Christian country, whatever that means now or in the past. We want it to be ours, and these people are different. They might be Americans, they might be citizens. We want them to be welcome, to have the freedoms that we enjoy, of course, but something is different with them, right? And to what degree is it different? And to what degree are we allowed to be okay with that difference? It's kind of hard to say. And where do we draw the lines? Is there a Christian answer? Now, with each of these three policy points, I don't know that there is. I mean, it's certainly worthy discussions. Our nation has to make up its mind. We as Christians have a share in influencing what our decision as a country will be. We must think deeply about that. But rather than proposing there is any one particular answer, I think there is a lot of answers that aren't right. Or at least there are a lot of approaches to answers that aren't right, that are not coming from a Christian place. Is there a Christian answer? Well, Romans gives us the Christian approach. Do not conform to the patterns of this world. What is the pattern that you tend to think these issues through? Now, certainly your political news channel of choice has a pattern that it approaches these issues on. May or may not be good, but it is a pattern of this world. Romans instead tells us to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. So whatever these issues are, as we search for the way that Christ wants us to think through them, our minds must operate differently than we see the world around us operating. And this, with Islam, is particularly difficult. Because with Islam, there are two patterns that are hitting us over the head in these days. And basically, there are patterns by people who want to put forward a picture. And of course, these pictures represent them quite well. There is the pattern that says of Islam, it is a religion of peace. Then there is the pattern that says it is a religion of violence. Now, people who are putting forth this pattern may have good reasons to do so. If our nation is at war with certain other Muslim nations, we do want to make it quite clear we're not at war with a religion or these religious people. So it's maybe necessary for our politicians to say, Islam is a religion of peace, we are not at war with, and define them as radical Muslims or however we want to put out the linguistics. But that message is coming through. It is a pattern. Islam is a religion of peace. Now, if that was the point of today's sermon, I could bring a whole lot of evidence to show you that it's actually quite true. But then there could also be a whole lot of evidence to show that it's not. That the other pattern has a great deal of validity as well. That there is that within Islam that pushes Muslims of certain varieties at certain times to violence. And that is part not just of their deviation from their faith, but actually the path of walking in their faith. But does that define Islam? Oh, no, not at all. And certainly there are plenty of Muslims, most of the Muslims of this world reject that absolutely. But what do we hear? Over and over again, religion of peace, religion of violence. And I would say that even though if there are some good reasons that we should believe those who are pushing these two distinct narratives, I would also say that there is a large agenda behind both of them. And neither one of these agendas serves Christ well. Why? Well, there are different reasons. One of them is that one of these agendas in particular is focused on fear. Right? I mean, certainly if we characterize much of the way our nation is currently thinking about Islam, that is how we would sum it up, right? Okay, yeah, there's lots of people out there in the world. They seem perfectly normal, these Muslims who are living among us, but then there's some of them, and we just don't know who they are, and we never know when they're going to crack. And what does that make us do? Makes us fearful. Fear is a natural human response, of course, even if it's a manipulated one for a lot of what our country is going through. The Bible speaks very clearly to fear. There's prudence, there's wisdom, but God has not given us a spirit of fear. When we find ourselves fearful, we must pause and remind ourselves Christianly, this is not of God. Now, that, of course, has no implications whatsoever on policy. Policy is about thinking clearly. Fear stops us from thinking clearly. What has God given us instead? A sound mind. He's given us love. So one of the patterns of Islam is relying on this sense, which is quite anti-Christian. But then there's another spirit related to Islam that shows that these patterns of thinking are not those which honor Christ, and that is generalization. Generalization can actually go two ways. There is the same sense of generalization that we put all Muslims in a box, and that kind of goes with one of those patterns of Islam is violent. But then there's another sense of generalization that goes a step beyond what any one individual person is, and it generalizes these religions are all the same. And if there is an agenda of some sort behind those who are pushing the narrative of Islam as a religion of peace, let us be wary when we hear that. Are they also saying that all our religions are the same? That they are equally good people because they are serving God just like some of us are serving God? Well, maybe. We dare not generalize ourselves in saying that those people who say such things have an agenda. We don't know what's in their heart. But it does seem to me that there is that idea behind much of those people who say Islam is a religion of peace. That does not give due justice to Christ and his uniqueness, to the differences in our understandings of God and in the ways we need to behave in this world. So, how do we sort with this? How do we deal through, if there is a Christian answer, how do we find it? I think one of the very important things for us to do next is to understand who we are. Now, this can be dangerous because once you start trying to figure out what is our identity, you can get into trouble. It's not bad. In fact, it's quite necessary. But we see even as of this very week with some of the things that are going on in race relations in the United States. If you start focusing too much on a particular slice of your identity, you risk losing the whole. Is that the same with Christianity, with our faith? I certainly see the implications over in Egypt and the Middle East. That you are a Muslim, or that you are a Christian, or that you are a Shia. If you want to break out the variety of Muslims, it's tearing their region apart. Maybe what we need is the sense of a whole, that we are all one people, no matter what slice we're in. And I would say that's quite true, but if it is, then what about our different identity that grounds us in Christ? How do we hold these things together? Well, an important place to start is Acts. Because Paul teaches us that from one man, God made every nation of the world and determined the times and the exact places that they should live. What does this mean? Well, in one sense, if there's any lingering doubt in your mind why you're here today, it's, well, because God has you in this church. He has you in Glassboro, New Jersey. But for this sermon, he has us in the United States of America. This is our country. It is our country by God's design. And within that, we have responsibilities to this place. And our identity as Americans is something that pleases God because he put us here. So if there is that sense in which we are all together, we need to keep our identity as a whole. Absolutely, I think for Christians, that is true. We need to take very seriously this country that God has given us and to steward it correctly in the way that pleases him. But of course, it's not just ours. There's plenty of other people in this country that aren't Christians, and it's theirs too. And together, we must work and cooperate so that we sort through these issues well. But even though dealing with identity runs risks, I think as Christians we have to run those risks even in parceling out and leveling our identity, because that's what God teaches us also. In 1 Peter, it calls us aliens and strangers in this world. We, as Christians, are a chosen people. God, of course, put people in every country of the world. And from every country of the world, he has called us out to be his church. I don't know that there's any ranking here. This is just a separate identity. But if indeed we are citizens of our country, we are also at the same time aliens and strangers. So yes, we belong to our country. God put us here. But as we wonder what we should do with Syrian refugees, we ourselves, in the spiritual sense, are refugees. This is not our home. But is there a ranking? Is one supposed to be higher than the other? Maybe. I don't want to say this absolutely, but Paul does seem to rank for himself. And that's Philippians. Paul goes through a long list of who he is, from this tribe of Israel, from this type of teaching. But what is that to him? Rubbish. That's a very strong statement that I would be careful myself to say, whoa, was that too much? Rubbish. I don't want to treat my American identity as rubbish. It's far closer to home than that. I don't suggest, but I think we would do well to deal with the tension that maybe Paul does suggest it. That of our identities, that value of us being in Christ is of such paramount value that everything else that is precious to us is as if it is rubbish. Maybe that doesn't sort how we choose and deal with our political issues, but it does, I think, sort our ultimate loyalties, that we are Christ's and we are found in him. All of this, perhaps, is preview, because we're trying to figure out how we can shape our understandings and deal with these issues that our country is facing, how we should relate and think about the Muslims who are in our midst, the Muslims in the world. But then how do we start dealing with that? And if you caught the hint in the beginning of the opening slide, these three remain comes from what is, in some sense, the central Bible verse of this passage, the chapter of love on 1 Corinthians. These three remain faith, hope, and love. And so no matter what it is in this world, of course, things will fade away, but these three remain. And if they remain, if these are the three most important virtues that make up this entire world, how should they shape our approach to Muslims? There's probably many ways. This is just a template, but these are the ideas that I hope to put forward. And when it comes to faith, there is the sense that with Muslims, we must have good faith. This is one of the ways in which I am most pleased to be a journalist, because it's my job to handle things in their entirety, to understand how people understand themselves, and to relate them properly, to represent them to others in ways that they would identify with and say, yes, that is me. And so to have good faith with Muslims is to have good faith with their religion, to treat faithfully what is Islam. And again, as we went to that issue, there are the two patterns of Islam we need to understand. This is just one verse that shows that there is that slice of Islam, treating it in good faith, that puts them against us. This is one translation of that verse. Another translation would say, do not take Jews or Christians as friends. A verse like this seems that we should recognize that they have us at odds, whether or not we have them at odds with us. To treat Islam faithfully recognizes that we have to deal with this approach that their religion has towards us. But it also deals with another verse that simply says, why did God make all these different peoples in the world? So that we can know each other. Inasmuch as there are some parts of the Quran that push Muslims towards a distinct community that is at odds with the world, there is that within Islam that also pushes Muslims to get to know every single type of different person in this world. To conquer them? To convert them? No. To know them. And that is a verse that animates millions of Muslims around the world. How do we hold these two verses in tension? Well, how do we hold different parts of the Bible in tension? Muslims have their ways. They have different schools of interpretation. Some may be more valid than others. That's not necessarily our job to figure out, but it is our job to represent well and to keep good faith with. Of course, there's many other examples we could have chosen about Islam, choosing this verse and setting it off against this one. How should we relate to them? Identify with their struggle. How would you hold these two verses in tension if these were your scriptures? If you wanted to be faithful to a God that said both. They struggle with this. Some of them emphasize one and get pushed off towards terrorism. Others will emphasize another and become great ambassadors of peace. Who's right and who's wrong? It's a fine discussion for another day. But if that is one sense of faith towards Muslims, there is another sense in which our responsibility is to walk with them in their faith. The next slide just shows two pictures. The first one is actually not of Muslims at all. These are two Coptic Christians. Another example of my work, there was a time over in Egypt where there was an incident that got Muslims angry, and they went and they burned a church. And I went over there a little bit later to that church, and I found people who were grieving, people who were angry. And in the course of writing my story, I was able at one point to simply put my hands on the shoulders of a man who was pacing back and forth almost violently and wondering, how could they have done this to them? What do we do back? Now, of course, he would have not have done anything at all back. Christians are 10% of Egypt. It would be foolhardy to try to retaliate in any sense, but that was his heart at the moment. And God was able, outside the scope of a story, to help me give him the word that you are of Christ, and greater is he that is inside of you than he who is in the world. That verse from 1 John also shows that you have already overcome them. Now, of course, I left that person in turn and went on to the other people I had to talk to. But there is that moment that as we deal with these issues, whatever country we live in, we walk with people in their faith. This other gentleman, the one who's not crying, is one of a young professor at the Ezhar, which is the central seminary for Islam in the entire Muslim world. So he's an up-and-coming person, not one of their top figures, but I got to join this man in his journey before I knew him. The village that he came from in Egypt, he used to think that within their churches, Christians would practice sorcery and torture any Muslim who thought that they might convert to Christianity. And that they would do this bizarre ritual where they would actually drink blood. Now, that's what he thought. It's not uncommon for Muslims of Egypt to think that of Christians. But yet, other people walked with him in the path, and now, where I get to join him, he is going to be the first professor at the Ezhar to go and get a master's degree in Christianity from the Vatican, so that he can come back to his country and, in his words, teach Christianity correctly. He says, we've been taught about Christianity from the Muslim perspective all our lives. He doesn't deny that it's right, of course, but he says it doesn't do justice to how Christians describe themselves. Would you help me understand Protestants, since I'm going to a Catholic university? Now, of course, my job gave me the privilege of intersecting with his life, but part of being faithful to Muslims is walking with them in their faith. There's another sense, if that is faith, that what else remains? Hope. Two more pictures. We think, what do we hope for Muslims? It's a bit of an odd question, I would think, because what do we hope for Buddhists? What do we hope for communists? What do we hope for Republicans? What do we hope for anybody? You know, maybe we hope that in this world they would come to think the same way we do with whatever it is we want to change in this world. But when we think Christianly about hope, it does boil down to the fact that we hope they would come to Christ. Now, this man with the big beard, as best I know, has not. He is, or was, a veteran jihadist that was with the group called Al-Jama'a al-Islamiyya, or the Islamic group, connected to those who bombed the World Trade Center the first time, not the one that brought it down, but the people who tried a few years earlier. And this is a fellow who I was able to sit down with, interview, get his perspective, and in the course of conversations also be able to share with him a bit about the gospel of Christ. I wouldn't say his heart was open, but his conversation was. What seeds did that plant? What did God do with it? I don't know. There came a political turn in Egypt. He was arrested, and he died in jail. So, that's all. We praise God that the profession we have gets us to speak with people like this, who maybe others can't. But in the course of life, no matter what that is in uniqueness, we get to work with the hope that Muslims might come to know Jesus. The other picture is not of a Muslim nor an Egyptian. That is our oldest daughter. who was baptized just a few weeks ago. And this has nothing to do with my life, really, but my wife, as a mother, had lots of opportunities as our daughter wanted to invite her Muslim and Christian friends to come and watch her get baptized, which is a very unusual experience. Most Egyptian Christians are Orthodox, and they baptize their babies as infants. So for a child or an adult, this was weird. They'd never really seen it before. And of course, a Muslim has no idea what baptism is to begin with. And the conversations that were able to open up, my wife was able to help several people think through how we believe the Bible teaches us that we express faith in a personal sense as our decision to follow Christ, as our daughter at age 9 3/4 has chosen to do so. We hope that for them. But then there's another sense of hope as well, because if that's what we hope for Muslims, that's maybe one thing, but what do we hope for Arabs? Right? What about Indonesians? Most of them are Muslims. What do we hope for Russians or Chinese or Canadians? We don't often think this way. Become Christian, sure, but there's that difference, right, between what we might hope for a Muslim in that religious sense and what we might hope for them as a citizen of a particular country. The next slide shows a verse that is very interesting and I hope will shape what our hope is for this world. Revelations tells us that the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nation. That, you could probably tell, is one of the very last chapters of the Bible. After Christ has returned, he has set the world right. So this is a hope that he will achieve, not something that we can ultimately do ourselves. But we tend to think of heaven, or when we die and everything is over, that we will be worshiping God kind of as an individual there, overwhelmed by his glory and, of course, utter paradise. But we'll just be there as an individual, and next to us will be another individual, and next to him will be another individual. In some sense, this verse reminds us that God has more in mind, that at the end of the days, the nations will be healed. If that is what God will eventually do to Syria, what should our hope for Syria be now? Or Iraq, or Canada, or the United States? How do we hope, and how do we let this hope channel whatever we think about the issues our world is facing today? Let us remember, part of a gospel hope is that the nations will be healed. And what role do we have in helping with that now? There is the last sense of the three that remain, that is love. 1 Corinthians tells us that love is the greatest of these. And therefore, I think it will do well for us to actually read a little bit of this passage. I could read, you can just listen. But feel free to turn yourself. I'll read slowly. And as I read this description of what love is, please think through the current events questions that were asked earlier. Maybe think through the Muslims that you might happen to kind of sort of know in your life right now. And how do these verses apply? Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. If we were to let these characteristics of our central Christian virtue shape the way we think about Muslims, in the abstract of the policies and politics of our nation, or in the particular for those individuals that we might happen to know, how would this change the way we think? You'll have your own answers. They might be different than mine. If love is patient, what does that mean we do with the generation of immigrants who have come over here and not yet integrated well into American society? If it is not self-seeking, what does that say about the United States and its perhaps very legitimate national interests? If it keeps no record of wrongs, how do we think back on Muslim history and the things that they have done and sometimes continue to do to Christians around the world? If it does not delight in evil, what does that say about perhaps a necessary but certainly a not good war that may happen to be waging in the world at any particular time? If it always protects, what does that say that we do with any Muslim who might be facing trouble or misunderstanding in our nation? If it always trusts, what does that say to this bunch of Muslims who are here and maybe changing, possibly, the fabric of our country? But there is a next verse after this passage. And when I warned you that this sermon risks being incomplete, this is where it may start to fall apart a little bit. Because the next verse says that love never fails. Now, all the verses before are descriptions of love. They are things that we can aim for, that we can do our best in. Love never fails is God's verdict. And so often it doesn't quite seem right. Because, okay, maybe I could bring myself to trust a Muslim or to trust that they are doing I don't know what in this world, but I have to trust them anyway. I can hope for the best, but what happens when it doesn't work out? Love never fails? I don't know. We don't know. That is God's judgment. Is it our future? We don't get to live that. We only walk in hope of it. Of course, God pushes us even further. Because we do serve a God who knew what we would do to him when he decided to come to the earth, right? He came to those that were not his own, and his own received him not. He came to we who were enemies. And what did he do? On the night he was betrayed, took a towel and he washed the feet of disciples who he knew would forsake him. Now, of course, he knew what would come after as well. But in that moment on the cross, by all appearances, Jesus failed. And he did so anyway. If we have to have that same attitude of service towards Muslims in general, and in particular, we don't know whether or not they will, in the end, betray us. We might hope that many will become Christians. Many across the world are. But then, a good handful are also shooting those people who throw them a nice welcoming party or treat them well on the army base that they serve at. We don't know what will happen. And that is where Christ leaves us, and it is where I am terribly uncomfortable to be asking Americans who don't know Muslims like we know them, for good and for ill, to trust, to love, to serve. Because what happens at the end? The very last slide. This is perhaps an ultimate end and the uttermost failure when there are Egyptian Christians in Libya who get their heads chopped off rather than deny their faith. Now, I think this is not in any sense our future in the United States, of course, but we are asked to have the same sense of dying to ourself in commitment to the principles that God has given us. Now, even this was not a complete failure. I can tell you that in Egypt, after this happened, the entire nation, Muslim and Christian together, poured out their sympathy and admiration for those who gave their lives for Christ. And the Bible Society of Egypt launched a small little tract. This is the pamphlet that was distributed more than any other pamphlet in Egyptian history, containing messages from the Bible about what those people did and the faith that they had, that went to Muslim and Christian alike to see what this was about. Now, the sermon is incomplete because is that an end that we would be satisfied with? Is that a way that we would, in a sense, allow our nation, if a worst-case scenario came to be? We don't know. Love never fails. God will somehow redeem it. And we must be willing to walk to such an end because we know that when Christ did so, there was resurrection on the other side. That was his plan for our salvation. And this sacrifice resulted, presumably, in other instances of salvation, but only through the death of those people who gave all they had to give, just as we must be willing to die to ourselves, to our particular patterns of this world, so that the principles of Christ can shape all of us, no matter where practically that might line up on any political spectrum at any particular point of time. I hope this has been encouraging. I hope it is something that will be a reminder for us and for our nation at this particular moment in history. And we thank you as a church that you have been able to shape and inform even this sermon through your prayers and encouragement and standing with us over the years. So thank you, and let's bow in prayer. God, thank you for this opportunity to share what you have taught us in our lives, that you have given us a chance to walk in a unique way. But that walk is one that is for all of us who are in you, no matter where we live, no matter our profession or the people we are around. And help this church to be faithful to those who it ministers to in a formal sense in its many programs, to those who it ministers to through the congregation, in the lives and the friendships that go out, no matter whom happens to cross the paths of those here. Bless our nation, give it wisdom to our politicians to make difficult decisions in difficult times. Bless the Middle East and bring peace there, and help people to set aside differences and come together to embrace one another in peace. Help Muslims to find a right path for their particular faith, that they would walk it in a way that most closely honors and reflects your principles. And remind us all of your great love for us, and that in you we have salvation, and for this we are thankful. In Jesus' name, amen.